dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201 CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. One of the biggest of the big lies is that government has its boot on so-called free enterprise. The reality is that media conglomerates manipulate the electoral process by pillorying or ignoring candidates unacceptable to corporate America. Corporate lobbyists let party bosses know which candidates can expect to benefit from corporate coffers and what is expected from them when elected. Corporations owe their very existence to the laws and lawmakers. Their ever-increasing transnational power has been ratified by so-called free trade agreements that are pushed by presidents, passed by legislatures, and enforced by armies. Consider this. Though more than 90% of delegates at the recent Democratic Convention want the U.S. out of Iraq, their presidential candidate plans to, quote, stay the course, unquote. What course might that be? Until Iraq is pacified enough to be divvied up as corporate spoils? Understanding the bottom line behind the pretense of democracy, a global movement determined to bring real democracy from below took to the streets in the 1990s and is consciously building alliances across national borders. In our second hour, we'll hear from Eddie Ewan, one of the editors of a new book, Confronting Capitalism, Dispatches from a Global Movement. In our first hour, a story which brings the contest of people versus profits closer to home. We'll speak with Jeremy Alderson about new developments in his court case against Cornell University's biotech programs and his insurgent congressional campaign.
My shiny black bears. I treat horses good.
Jeremy Alderson is known to radio listeners nationwide as Nobody, the air name he uses as the host and director of the Homelessness Marathon radio broadcast that strives to focus a spotlight on the plight of millions of people homeless in America. For the past few years, he has also been battling Cornell University in court to compel them to make public the nature, extent, and safety of their biotechnology experiments in the Finger Lakes. He knows what it's like to take on a powerful institution that dominates a small community. But so far, he's winning. Recently, he entered the race for the Democratic Party nomination for New York's 29th Congressional District, which includes all or parts of Ontario, Monroe, Yates, and Schuyler counties. The longtime incumbent, Republican Amo Houghton, is retiring, making this congressional seat one of the few considered truly up for grabs in the nation. Ronnie Cummins, national director of the Organic Consumers Association, recently said, quote, Jeremy Alderson was quick to recognize that no matter which way the political winds were blowing, they'd be ill winds if they were filled with GMO pollen. He acted on his own to fight the growing contamination of our food. That's why we can have confidence that if he gets to Washington, he'll represent consumers, not corporations. Close quote. Alderson has found that he has had to confront dirty politics, not from Republicans, but from his own party, whose establishment has used every means possible to stop him from getting on the ballot. I spoke with him earlier this week about new revelations in his lawsuit against Cornell and about his congressional campaign. Before I play this tape, I feel obliged to inform listeners of the following. Jeremy Alderson is a longtime friend and colleague, a person who I consider to be of the highest integrity. I am a resident of New York's 29th district where Alderson is running, and though not a Democrat, I am a volunteer with his campaign. The interview I'm about to play pulls no punches and names names. In the interest of fairness, I invite anyone mentioned on this program who wishes to respond to be interviewed, or to submit a statement in writing for me to read on the air. You can contact me directly at lyn@ithacaradio.org, that's lyn@ithacaradio.org, or through our website at unwelcomeguests.org. I began by asking Alderson to explain the history of his lawsuit against Cornell University.
Well, as many people know, I was a talk host on WEOS in Geneva for years. I think I had been already on the air doing the Nobody Show for, it's hard for me to remember, 6 or 7 years, something like that. And one of the things that I had been very much opposed to was genetic engineering in foods. I think this is a dangerous hubris of a kind we've already seen too much of as we are driving drunk down the road to Armageddon, and I was always very concerned about it. And then I saw a piece in the Ithaca Journal, which was a puff piece, touting the fact that the Geneva Ag Station was, Cornell's Geneva Ag Station, was going to try and expand into an ag tech park, technically. Now it's called the Cornell Agriculture and Food Technology Park, but it's known as the Ag Tech Park. And they were going to expand into that and do field testing, possibly, of genetically modified crops there and so forth. And, of course, this was presented in the local business news section, not as anything to be concerned about. And, I nearly fell out of my chair. Now, it wasn't that I didn't know there was all kinds of stuff going on at Cornell, but, just the idea that they would present this as happy news really floored me. And, of course, they don't do investigative reporting, and they don't do any criticism of Cornell at the Journal. But I was concerned about it, and since I was broadcasting in Geneva, and this was going to be planned for Geneva, I decided to investigate further, and I had been doing that for a long time. I didn't normally talk about local issues, but sometimes there were local issues of importance, like when Guardian Glass was going to open a factory in the Geneva area. So I had been in the habit of making freedom of information requests to the city of Geneva and so forth, and pretty well had established channels for getting information. I requested information from the ag station, Cornell's ag station, and they were not cooperative. And, I put in the request, though. I said, consider this. If you are susceptible to freedom of information, please consider this a freedom of information request. And I really didn't know whether it was or wasn't. It wasn't really an issue to me. I just tacked it on because I know that an official legal FOIL, Freedom of Information Law, as opposed to FOIA, Freedom of Information Act, that's federal, and FOIL is New York State. So a FOIL request has a certain legal clout, and I just tacked it on. And they wrote back to me saying that because of this precedent, the case, from Dr. Hunter, I got a letter, the head of the whole thing, saying that because there had been this court case, Stoll versus the New York State College of Veterinary Medicine, which is one of the state schools at Cornell, they were exempt. The court had decided that they were exempt from freedom of information.
How long ago did you first make the request?
Without having my files in front of me, I'd have to be guessing, but it certainly couldn't have been any earlier than 1999 or early 2000, somewhere in there. They sent me the name of a court case which they claimed made them exempt from FOIL. And the obvious thing I was going to do, which is what I did, I went immediately to the Cornell Law School and looked the case up. And when I found the case, I found out that they had directly misrepresented what the case said. The case explicitly and unambiguously, they said, by this decision, we are not saying that everything at Cornell is exempt from FOIL. Other more public aspects of their operations may be subject to FOIL laws. The particular Stone case involved discipline records, and there were internal reasons why the court found those were not subject to the Freedom of Information law. They were private records. The state had never had an oversight function. They kept the records from the public and private branches of Cornell mixed in the same place. There really was no public aspect, but they said more public aspects might be subject to FOIL. And they lied, basically. They had just misrepresented. And so I was quite outraged by that. And that was quite clearly a question of throwing down the gauntlet. It was a slap in the face, and they were basically saying, we're not giving you these documents. We don't care what we say to you. You're not getting them, and you're going to have to do something.
What were you asking them to tell you?
What I was asking for in general was safety documents. I wanted to see what evidence they had that the planting of genetically modified organisms or GMOs was safe. And I wanted to see who was paying for the research, because you know these people who are working with these things always say it's for humanitarian reasons. I wanted the names of the humanitarians who were funding their research. Well, they wouldn't cough that stuff up. So I started making more requests just to have a file of all the things I was asking for. And I appealed to the New York State Department of State has an open government committee. That's the next stop in the FOIL process. And they ruled in my favor. It's a non-binding opinion, but they said that I was right and that Cornell should be giving me those documents. And since Cornell wasn't about to, the only legal recourse you have then is to go and find a lawyer. I was very, very fortunate that to find a law firm that would take the case. I was very fortunate to speak to Ray Schlather at Lopinto Schlather, Solomon and Salk. And they're a firm that I think does a lot of the human rights, civil rights kinds of work in Ithaca. And they took the case basically as a pro bono case. So Diane Campbell was assigned as the counsel. She's their freedom of information expert there. Technically, it was not pro bono because they did have some possibility of recovering funds. But it's a very remote possibility in a case like this. They took it knowing that they probably wouldn't. So I'm very grateful to them. Diane has done a wonderful job. And basically, so far, we've had five rounds in court, and no court has upheld Cornell's view. No one has said that Cornell was right.
So what's been the progress of the case through the courts at this point?
Well, it started out in Tompkins County Supreme Court, and as people may know, ironically, in New York State, the Supreme Court is the lowest level court. And the issue there was, is Cornell subject to the Freedom of Information Law, the basic issue? And Judge Mulvey and the Supreme Court said yes. They said yes at the next level. Went up to the New York State Court of Appeals. And they could have just thrown it out and said no, you know. But they instead said, we want to see a full record. They wanted to know what specific documents we were talking about. And that seems to be indicative, but not conclusive, that they are prepared to rule that some of the documents are subject to the Freedom of Information Law, and they want to know the specifics, but I can't say that for sure. It went back down to the Supreme Court, and Cornell was required to provide a list of documents, and then the judge ruled that some of those documents should be released to us. Others, they should be redacted with the names taken out before they were released to us. Others were not subject to FOIL, but this is the first ruling in history where any judge ever said, yes, these are specific documents subject to the Freedom of Information Law that Cornell has. And now Cornell has appealed back up to the Court of Appeals. And this fall, probably in a month or two, we should have the last showdown.
Okay, now what names? You mentioned names taken out. What names would be taken out? And what argument was Cornell making as to why these documents should not be provided?
Cornell was claiming that the release of people's names might lead to terrorist acts. They are concerned, they say, that
Employees of Cornell? Are these researchers? Who are these people that they're concerned about?
Yeah, these are some of the researchers who were doing the research with the GM crops there, and they are claiming that they are concerned for the well-being of these people. We argued against this. First of all, on the Ag Station's website, they identify these people publicly themselves, and they even print their pictures. And so we said this was ridiculous, in legalese, of course. We said this was ridiculous because Cornell identifies these people, and if you're going to cite a threat like this, you have to have some specific reason for it. It can't be just generic. But the court ruled that in certain cases they would require us to redact the names, and we're not really making an issue out of that point because this certainly was not the crucial point for us, was what the names of these people were. What we're really concerned about is the information that the documents can't contain. As long as we get access to the documents, that's not something we're that deeply worried about.
Have you been able to access any of the documents that you were originally seeking up until this point, or have you still not seen anything?
We have not seen a single document. That is what is still being debated in court. The judge in Supreme Court saw the documents. But we actually did get the most important single thing that we wanted out of this lawsuit already. And the way that happened was that when Cornell presented a list of documents to the Supreme Court saying, well, this is what the FOIL requests Alderson has made, this is what they would cover if he wins. That's what they were required to do. And we went back into court and we said, well, there's a whole bunch of things that are missing here. And we listed hundreds of pages of documents which Cornell did not include in its list to the court. For instance, they were supposed to list all of the financial documents. Well, we could take off of their websites things where they said they had received this grant or their work had been funded by this organization. Well, where were those funding papers? Where were the grant papers? There was nothing. Well, this was the most important single thing that we had wanted to see because Cornell prepared a submission for the New York State Legislature, in which it claimed to have certain things in its possession. They needed the legislature's approval to be able to build the Ag Tech Park because the land they wanted to build on was technically owned by SUNY, which is controlled by the legislature, and so they needed enabling legislation to be able to do it. And they sent, as a PR piece, they sent a series of questions and answers about the proposed Ag Tech Park to the legislature in order to secure their approval. And this was one of the questions they asked. Doesn't the field testing of GMOs jeopardize the Finger Lakes ecosystem? That was what they asked of themselves. And their answer was, to the best of our scientific knowledge, and we do conduct risk assessment studies, the risk is negligible. That was what they answered, in part. So we said, wait a minute here. Where are those risk assessment studies on your document list? You know, the ones you told the legislature you had. And they responded back in a sworn affidavit to the court. Remember, they weren't under oath when they wrote to the legislature trying to get what they wanted. But under oath, they wrote back, respondents do not now have documents referred to as risk assessment studies. That's what they said to the court.
And the time period between the presentation to the legislature and the response that they did not have these risk assessment studies was how long?
4 years, approximately. But you have to understand what a risk assessment study is. First of all, they didn't say they had one. They said, we do perform risk assessment studies, plural, as an ongoing process. And a risk assessment study means that you take data and you collate the data and you make some estimates based on the data according to some kind of an algorithm. You pass it around for review and somebody makes a final judgment on it. It has to be, all of that stuff has to be in bunches of files. There has to be people who gather the data, people who review the data, people who make decisions on it. You can't lose risk assessment studies. You just can't lose them. So the only possible interpretations are, A, they never performed any risk assessment studies, or B, they did, and the risk assessment studies showed the work to be dangerous, and they destroyed them to keep them out of the hands of any critics through my court case. But either way, it's quite clear that they lied to the legislature because they couldn't possibly have had in their possession any risk assessment study that showed their work to be safe.
Now, regarding the legislature and their oversight function, during the process of approving this land use by the legislature, did any of those people in the legislature demand to see these risk assessment studies? Did anyone at the county level, at the city level, what was the local government doing regarding these questions about risk for this facility, as far as you know?
To my knowledge, I am the only person who ever asked to see these. Marty Luster, who was the assemblyman from Ithaca at the time, promised me that he would not vote to approve this until he saw the safety data from Cornell, and he broke his word to me. And I have never felt very friendly to him ever since, because I'm not really somebody who thinks, oh, it's all just politics. I think that if you take a stand on something and you give your word, you better keep it. Now, one thing I do not know is who received these questions and answers in the legislature. I don't know, and I cannot say if every legislator got them or not. Interestingly enough, as you may be aware, I'm running for Congress, and one of my potential Republican opponents, Randy Kuhl, is actually on the state Senate's Agriculture Committee. He's the head of the Agriculture Committee. He has said he never saw these documents, and he even went so far as to say that the Agriculture Committee is not a watchdog group, which raises an interesting question. If the state Senate's Agriculture Committee is not there to protect the people of New York State, who is?
During the years that this has been moving through the courts, what has been the status of the progress of this facility?
It is now moving ahead. The project was stalled for a year. When I talked about this on my radio show, this got more of a listener response than any issue I ever brought up. And it was the record was only eclipsed after the 9/11 attacks when people wanted to talk about that for obvious reasons. People were outraged. And one of my listeners, an organic farmer, said he would fax things to every single member of the Higher Education Committee, which where the bill, the enabling bill, was bottlenecked because the Higher Education Committee oversees SUNY. And he did that. And the thing stalled for a year. Now, there were other reasons why it stalled. There was another assemblyman actually from out of this area who was concerned about the precedent for the kind of legislation they were going to put forward to help Cornell. So it's not clear why it stalled. There was more than one reason. I certainly hope we helped to stall it. But in the end, Cornell got what it wanted. And the point that I would make is very simple. If I go into a bank and I make false statements to secure a loan, I am legally culpable for that. Cornell quite clearly made false statements to get this enabling legislation passed for a multi-million dollar project, from which they fully intend to profit in many ways. Well, why is no one going to hold them accountable for that? I think it's very important that their feet be held to the fire, but there just seems to be no will anywhere to do it.
Okay, well, let's talk about Cornell's accountability and who might do that. When you announced your bid to seek the Democratic nomination for the 29th District Congressional seat that's being vacated by Amo Houghton, you also announced this information regarding this lawsuit with Cornell on this biotech issue. What kind of response did you have from the local press about this?
Well, let me be clear. The two issues, the two announcements were not simultaneous, but in any case, the local press has not responded very well. I mean, the Ithaca Journal ran a very poor piece on it. I must say, Andrew, who wrote the piece, I think is a good reporter and a conscientious one, but I think she got a little confused. And then the Ithaca Journal refused to print my letter, trying to set some things straight, saying that while it was in litigation, they didn't want to have a letter on this, even though, in fact, none of the points that are in litigation were covered by my letter. It's as if they've said to me, you've lost any right to write a letter to the Ithaca Journal because you're suing Cornell. It doesn't matter what you raise. So I was very disappointed in that. The Canandaigua Daily Messenger did a story about it because they are the paper closest to the affected area that's in the district that I'm running in. But other than that, there hasn't been much of a response. And I personally gave the papers into the hands of the chief of staff for, I can never remember her name, Barbara, whatever her name is, the one who's taken Martin Lester's place in the assembly.
Lifton.
Yeah, Barbara Lifton. And Barbara Lifton has done nothing. She's never contacted me, and I've given it to her, the sworn affidavit from Cornell and how it contrasted. I've given her copies of what they said to the legislature. Barbara Lifton has had no interest in this whatsoever, and shame on her.
Okay, well, set the record straight now. What was in the Ithaca Journal story that you felt was inaccurate or a misrepresentation?
The Ithaca Journal story confused different issues, and they confused the issue with whether or not Cornell was properly handing over documents with the specifics of this particular document they claimed not to possess. So They acted, our original claim was, Cornell, you're not handing over every document you must have in your possession. That's what we said in court, and we listed those things, and then they cited Cornell's answer to that. Well, that's fine, but we can't know what's in Cornell's file. So all we can do is go into the court and say we think things are missing. I still believe they sandbagged us on that. But we have no investigative power, neither does the court. So when they say we don't have it in our possession, the court has to accept that statement. There's nothing that can be done. But that wasn't the issue. The issue wasn't whether or not they were bringing documents into the court. It's that they swore they didn't have this very specific document, which they had previously told the legislature that they had. So they kind of let Cornell say, well, what is he talking about? We don't have the documents, as if that was the point in answer to our question about, in general, why aren't you providing everything, whereas the real issue was this specific document. Where are those risk assessments? That's what got confused in the journal piece.
And that was what you have termed the smoking gun.
Well, there's no question. You got a piece of paper in which they say we have these documents, and you got a sworn affidavit in which they say they don't have them. Something is not right there. And you don't have to be a rocket scientist to say, let's get to the bottom of this. Not the Ithaca Journal, not Barbara Lifton, and certainly not Randy Cool is in the slightest interested. And I really don't understand why.
What do you know about the nature of the experiments that they are planning to carry out at this AgTech park?
I don't know anything about the nature of those experiments. They don't have tenants yet, so we don't know who is going to be doing what. But we do know that they're already doing GMO experiments at Cornell and have been for a long time. The Geneva Ag Station was possibly the first, and if it weren't the first, they were one of the very first research institutes to put genetically modified bacteria into the environment. I mean, they did this with great fanfare. Well, genetically modified bacteria are the single most dangerous GMOs that can be put into the environment in terms of their potential impact and spreading and all the ways they can combine. So we know they've done this kind of thing. And another point is that because of who they are, they expose our ecosystem to more kinds of danger. If you live in rural, Idaho or Nebraska or something, you might be exposed to a kind of genetically modified corn or two, maybe a kind of soybean or two. But it is only because we live next to a major world research institution that we are exposed to things that are not on the market yet. Genetically modified squash and melons and tomatoes, even papayas they've worked on up there. So there are all kinds of things they are working on in those labs which are not in commercial production, which nobody even thinks are ready for commercial production. And we don't know even the most basic questions, like, are there adequate filters on their greenhouses for the things that are still in the greenhouse stage? Is the pollen escaping and drifting so that it can be combining with native plants? We don't know a thing. But what we do know is that by the standard Cornell itself set, because Cornell was assuring the legislature, well, we've got risk assessments, and if that's what the standard they set was for what would make us think this work was safe, they don't have them. They haven't met their own standard.
This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm speaking with Jeremy Weir Alderson, journalist, activist, and a Democratic congressional candidate for the 29th District of New York.
What the strategy has been by Cornell, and not just by Cornell, but all the big GMO institutions, whether they're seed companies or they're research institutions, is to claim that there are these stringent federal regulations under the FDA or the USDA or wherever they may be that really require great scrutiny of this work. And therefore, they say, we don't need anything more because look at all these regulations we have to comply with. What they don't tell you is that the GMO industry lobbied Washington to make these regulations as lax as possible. They practically have to do nothing to get permission to put these things in the fields. They don't have to show that these things are safe. So they have invented a lax regulatory system because they lobbied for it, and then they point to the very lax regulatory system they created as proof that they're being bound by these very harsh rules. And it's just a big dog and pony show and a lie.
Now, you have said that you believe that your raising of this issue on your radio show was responsible for it being pulled off the air. What happened?
Let me be clear, I don't have 100% proof, but I am entitled. I still think in America you're allowed to believe what you believe, and I believe Cornell got me taken off the air. What happened was, without warning, after more than 9 years on WEOS, in the middle of a conversation with Mike Black, my station manager, which I had actually called him about something else, he said, oh, by the way, you know, you've lost your time slot, with no warning whatsoever. And his claim was that there were so many students who needed the time slots. They had more students than ever who want to get on the air, and they just couldn't help it. They had to take the time slot away from me.
Explain why that would be. Why would a student be able to remove you from the air?
Well, WEOS is the radio station of Hobart and William Smith Colleges, and so there is a certain legitimate hierarchy. There are students who it's their radio station to learn on. There are professors who might want to do shows. And then there is room for community people. And I came in under the community person allocation, which isn't a firm allocation. Basically, when I came on that station, there was nothing happening. So they were happy to have. Mike was very supportive and happy to have me there. And Mike was always supportive of my show. But all of a sudden, there's no time. There's not even time. They got so much pressure from students all of a sudden, there's not even time for me to do a farewell broadcast. I'm just gone. Now, the story about student pressure was a total and absolute fabrication. The fact was that World Cafe, which is a music show, was repeating for more than a year after I was taken off because they didn't have a full schedule and they had to find things to fill it with. And so they repeated a music show, which they could have easily not done and left me with my time slot. Someone else, another professor at Hobart and William Smith, talked to Mike Black.
Can you name the person, or must it remain confidential?
I guess it's probably better if it remains confidential. I just don't really feel any need to drag this person into it, because there's not any proceeding going on. Why bother? But somebody talked to Mike Black and said, "Well, I'm sure he just told me this story he told you." And I said, "Well, what did he tell you?" And she said, he told me he was summoned into the president's office. That's Mark Guerin, who is the president of Hobart & William Smith. And he was told, we had a big complaint about this guy. And he's not a member of the community, meaning I'm not somebody there with a right, like a professor or a student. And this person said that what Mike Black claimed to her was that Mark Guerin said, well, he's not a member of the community, so get rid of him. Now, that's what I was told Mike Black had said. This is hearsay. It wouldn't be allowed in a court of law. Mike Black himself, interestingly enough, told me that there had been a break-in, a tire-slashing incident up at the Cornell Ag Station in Geneva. And when I got the police report, it turned out that the tire-slashing incident had occurred the day before I was taken off the air. And the sequence was that on October 4th, I did a broadcast in which I had 10 minutes on Cornell. Now, I had been excoriating Cornell for years on the broadcast, and nothing had ever happened except Cornell had claimed in court that if I was allowed to get documents, it would lead to terrorism. They have one break-in 4 days after I make a broadcast. I was on October 4th. I spoke for 10 minutes about Cornell. On October 8th, they had their tires slashed, and on October 9th, I was off the air. Doesn't take much to put two and two together and conclude that after the tire slashing incident, somebody at Cornell called Mark Guerin up and said, you see, this guy is fomenting terrorism. Never mind that there hadn't been any incidents for years when I'd been talking about Cornell. And they put the pressure there, and the next thing you know, I'm off the air. Now, another little interesting aspect of this is that in the Ag Station's own publication, they refer to Hobart and William Smith as one of their partners that brings interns to them. And after a respectable, if you call it respectable, interval, all of a sudden, these microbe world spots started showing up, paid spots on WEOS. They're produced by the Association for Microbiology, but in the spots it says, made possible on WEOS by the Boyce Thompson Institute. Boyce Thompson, located at Cornell, is the major gene splicing institute probably in the world that encourages GMO research. So somehow, after a tire slashing incident, the next day I'm out of my show, and after a discreet interval, they're getting money from the big biotech institute at Cornell. It's a little suspicious, to say the least.
Did these events have anything to do with your decision to run for Congress?
No, honestly not. What the relationship is, it's what got me into activism in the first place, what made me want to do a show in the first place. This is an example of it. There was not one legislator, not one politician in the state of New York who ever asked to see, to my knowledge, those safety documents from Cornell. And I think this is the kind of thing people are fed up with. We're fed up with having politicians who are watching out for money and not watching out for people. What I'm concerned about is the integrity of our political system and the fact that every time you hear a politician open his mouth, what you're really hearing is money talking. And I'm like a lot of people. I'm sick of it.
What have been your experiences on the campaign trail?
The race here in the 29th Congressional District is a little microcosm of what's going on nationally with the Democratic Party. People are sick of the Democrats, and rightly so, because they are spineless, corrupt, accommodationists. You know, the Republicans say jump and the Democrats say how high. So when Bush proposes these terrible tax cuts, instead of saying like they should have said, no, we need a different vision for America, they just said, oh, let's have little smaller tax cuts. That's how they are. Well, here in the 29th Congressional District, the party chairs coalesced around this candidate, Samara Baron, who's 26 years old, and they decided that they wanted to anoint her as the candidate because she is a Republican light. She calls herself a moderate or a centrist kind of candidate. She's exactly the kind of, you know, Democratic Leadership Council candidate, the kind they're encouraging, this stands-for-nothing kind of Democrat. And that was what they thought was going to be their ticket to winning the district. And they discouraged all other candidates from coming into the race because they were going to unite around Samara. And they weren't able to discourage me because, frankly, I'm used to doing things which nobody supports. So, you know, you want to go up against Cornell, you want to fight to get documents, any of the kinds of things activists would normally do, you want to be against the war. You're not waiting for somebody's approval. But they did chase other people out of the race, and so I find myself in a race with Samara. I find her the most vacant candidate I think I've seen in my life. I don't respect her politics, and I'm not going to pretend that I do. But in any case, in order to further her candidacy, they basically conspired to keep me from even being able to speak to the Democratic committees, even though I'm a Democrat. They went one up. No longer is this a case of, oh, third-party candidates stay out and leave it to the Democrats. Now they're saying you stay out even though you yourself are a Democrat. You're not the right Democrat. So five of the county chairs outright would not let me speak to their committees. That's Shemung, Schuyler, Cataraugus, Yates, and Monroe. They would not let me speak to their committees. Schuyler is where I live. I finally got to speak in Schuyler because I showed up uninvited at one of their meetings. And I confronted the chairman, chairwoman, actually. I was prepared to commit civil disobedience and be arrested, getting dragged out of that meeting if she didn't let me speak. And I think, you know, maybe she just all of a sudden decided to do the right thing. I doubt that, because the person who tipped me off about the meeting, she screamed at later on and told her you should never have told him about the meeting. But I think she must have understood that I wasn't going to go for this, because she relented and let me speak for 5 minutes. And I got to speak in Shemung when the chair was out of the country. But basically, that's the only way I could speak in those. Steuben in Ontario, by the way, counties treated me very well, I want to say.
People may not be familiar with this process and the meetings, and what is the significance of these? Can you just explain a little bit about that?
Well, the significance about this is it's very great, because in order to get on the ballot, if there is more than one candidate, you need, as a congressional candidate, 1,250 valid signatures of Democratic voters in the district. Well, if you have the manpower of the Democratic committees behind you, it's easy to get those signatures. If you don't have their support, you have to go out there and really hit the pavement to get them. It's hard to do by yourself without support, and certainly without money, since I didn't have money to pay people to do it for me. By shutting me out of these Democratic committee meetings, that meant that I would not be able to get support from people to go out and carry my petitions. They wouldn't know who I was. They wouldn't have any idea why they even would want to carry my petitions. My opponent, Samara Baron, of her 423 pages of signatures that she filed in Albany for her candidacy, 259 came out of the counties where I was not allowed to speak at all. If I'd been allowed to speak there and had gotten just a little bit of that support, it would have made my job a whole heck of a lot easier.
Are you on the ballot now? What is the situation?
I am on the ballot in the same sense that in America you're innocent until proven guilty. We filed, we needed 1,250. We filed something like 1,586 signatures.
And how did you get those signatures?
We got them because I went out, my wife Ellen went out, and we had some volunteer help. And we went out and we got them ourselves. I personally got 940 signatures. Samara Barron, by the way, her total signature collection count was zero. She never went out for a minute.
What's involved in getting a signature? You need to go up to a person one by one and ask them to sign your petition?
That's correct. And we had a little statement we gave out, which told them where I stood. And we asked them, would they sign? And were they Democrats? We asked them first. And that's how we got them. And I stood out hours in the sun. We both lost weight. We were working so hard. And we were out for so many hours doing this, really two people. We got 140 signatures from the other seven volunteers combined, which is about what you get. Samara had 150 volunteers or something. They each got a page or two. But now the signatures are being challenged. Dan McCandless, who is the Cattaraugus County Chair and an endorser of Barron, is challenging my petitions and trying to throw me off the ballot. So they have kept up this strategy of trying to shut me out, trying to keep me off the ballot. And the entire idea is just to have this Republican light candidate who stands for nothing. And I am quite outraged by it. And I was quite outraged by Barron's candidacy from the get-go. She's, she was going to run on this idea that she had helped to get Route 17 made into Route 86, Interstate 86. And when I came into the race, she had no position whatsoever on little things, like the war in Iraq. And she still has a meaningless position on the war in Iraq. I think that is quite offensive to the voters of this district. People are dying. People are worried about their fathers, their mothers, their sons and daughters, their brothers and sisters over there. The idea that you're going to run for office and simply have nothing to say about it, I just think that's offensive. We are in bad times in this country, facing real challenges, and the least that should be expected of a politician is to forthrightly discuss the issues that are facing the country.
So what do you think are the most important issues facing the country at this time?
It's not one issue. It's a package of issues that can generally be summarized by turning the country around and going into a different direction is what we've got to do. We're turning into the kind of country we have created elsewhere, as, for instance, in Chile, when we overthrew a democratically elected government and helped to install a dictator. And what happened? The people lost their rights. The gap between rich and poor became greater. The democratic basis of the government was disintegrated. These are the things that are happening here. We're turning into a kind of a hyperized third world country. We're not really a third world country because we're infinitely wealthier than any of the third world countries. But we're going to become, or are becoming, increasingly a rightless people, where the government has enormous police powers, where we're in this kind of permanent warfare, and where all the funds are being stripped away from the poor and for programs for the poor, while the wealthy are getting incredibly wealthy, even more than they already were. And the disparity between rich and poor is growing. The rich keep getting richer and the poor keep getting poorer. What's in between them that's going to get ripped apart is the fabric of our society. Right now, preserving this democracy, the integrity of our political system, and creating a decent society in which ordinary people can hope to live and afford housing and feed their families and have a hope for their children and for the education of their children and get medical care. It's really about creating that kind of society instead of a militarized caste system where the people are living under an iron boot with little hope.
You've been involved in poverty issues for a long time as a result of your radio broadcasting work and other activism. In the 29th district, how prevalent is poverty?
This is a poor district. I don't have the statistics at my fingertips, but huge numbers of people qualify for food stamps. Huge numbers of people are on disability or on welfare and stuff like that. So these are very real issues, and the other part of the issue is that there are no jobs. I spoke to a lot of people, and this is one of the painful parts of being out there and meeting people. I spoke to a lot of people who said they've been looking for jobs and they can't find them. And, you know, really people were quite broken up about it. I remember talking in Bath, the woman who was in tears, she took my hands, she practically wouldn't let me go, talking about what a hard time she's having. Because what is an unskilled worker going to do? What are they going to do? You're going to go to the 7-Eleven for a job, and if they're not hiring, where do you go in this environment? And by the way, this is one of the things that's wrong with job training, which is one of the things that Sam Baron is for. Job training is a code word for leaving people in poverty. The real issue is that unskilled jobs have to pay a living wage. The companies are trying to dumb down their work. That's why they got little pictures of hamburgers on the cash register at McDonald's. You're not supposed to be thinking anymore. The companies want unskilled laborers, but at the same time, they're financing a political system where people say, well, you have to have training to be worthy of getting enough money to live on. No. Unskilled people at 7-Eleven or pushing a picture of a burger at a McDonald's need to be able to make enough money to live. And that is an issue that I am raising. That's an issue that affects thousands of people in this district. And of course, it's an issue that I am the only one who's going to be raising in this district, because neither the Republicans nor Sam Baron are going to mention it.
One of the things that you've listed as part of your campaign positions is soak the rich. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, well, it was kind of tongue-in-cheek. I said, that's my tax policy, is soak the rich. And I said, I'll give the same rationale for that that they gave for throwing people off of welfare, which is it'll be good for them. You know, where are you going to get the money? What did Willie Sutton say when they asked him why he robbed banks? He said, that's where the money is. Somehow we've gotten this idea. It's gone beyond the idea of celebrity justice, you know, where rich people walk free. Now it's gotten to the idea, why, it's just an insult to ask a rich person to pony up some money. Back in the 50s, the corporations paid a much larger share of the taxes in this country. If they paid the same share today, I've read somewhere we wouldn't even need income taxes, just if we put the corporate tax rate back to where it used to be. So somehow we've gotten this idea, well, let's not take any money from the rich. You know, there is a statistic that a lot of people have heard about how the relationship between a CEO pay and the average worker's pay has gone up by something like 40-fold, that the CEOs are enriching themselves so much more now than they ever did. And one of the things I point out is, what were we in the 50s? Was this communist Russia? What kind of country was that? This was a capitalist country that was doing just fine as a capitalist country and without these kinds of grotesque and disproportionate payments to the wealthy. Now, let me also say that we had real social problems in the 50s. The 50s were a very peculiar decade for a lot of reasons, that we were kind of in a national denial. It was after the Depression and World War II, and people really didn't want to be bothered with another problem under the surface. You know, the civil rights movement was building up, and then it broke out in the mid-50s under the surface. You know, the beatniks were coming, and that broke out into the 60s, into the hippie movement. So a lot of the movements that really transformed this country were building up in the space of denial that was going on in the 50s. Remember, the 50s was still the time of Jim Crow. Black people weren't allowed to vote in the South. They couldn't ride in the front of the bus. This was no wonderful period in a lot of ways. But compared to some of what's going on today, yeah, we ought to remember back in those days, rich people paid more in taxes, corporations paid more in taxes, and the whole world didn't fall to pieces. Oh, another thing, back then, City University in New York was free. Today it's not. Your state universities were practically free. The whole idea was we had a nation which said that's a priority for us, is to make education affordable for the children of our people. Well, today you have to take out a loan to go to a state college. Scholarships have dried up. Used to be you got health care with a job in the 50s. You don't get health care necessarily anymore. So these are all of the ways in which the wealth has been drained from the lower classes in this society. They don't have the same privileges in America in terms of opportunities, healthcare, that they used to have even just 40 and 50 years ago. I call this the process of shortening the warranty. If you sell a refrigerator and you want to lower your cost, but you don't want to make the product look cheap, you sell the same product, but instead of giving a 2-year warranty, you give a 3-month warranty. So you're paying out less on the back end. And that's what's happened in general, is that we've shortened the warranty. You know, the country kind of looks the same, but you get a job, it doesn't pay anymore, and you can't go to school and all of that. How have they kept this out of the debate? I think it's a combination of things. First of all, the whole intent of shortening the warranty is to deceive you, to make it look like you're getting the same product. That was the idea. So there's a kind of national denial. Kids still do go to school, after all. They still go to the state colleges, so it looks kind of like the same thing, but it's really not. And then you have the obvious other factor, which is the money that's in the political process and the corporate control over the media, which effectively shut these issues out from any kind of consideration, because I'm here to tell you, if you're a candidate who will raise these issues, you're not getting the support of your party. I'm sure not.
And what kind of treatment have you been getting from the media thus far?
It's varied. I thank you for this interview, and that's why we need independent media in this country. And some of the reporters, I think, have been decent. I think I'm a little shocked how little investigative reporting goes on, how few questions are being asked about all of the candidates. There should be more, including me. So I think the press, this is not the crackerjack reporter age. There's too little competition. There's no real fighting for scoops anymore. I think the whole press has been degraded. And then I think there have been, just out-and-out disgraceful things that have happened. The Elmira Star Gazette, for instance, did a piece in which they sent their reporter out to find out what were the top issues in the district. And they said, the issues are pretty much the same throughout the district. They listed five, and the one they gave the most prominence to was converting Route 17 to Route 86. I've spoken to thousands of people. I've been on the streets. No one ever mentioned this issue to me. They didn't have polling data. They just proclaimed that that's what they had decided was the issue. And it's hard to believe it would be an issue up in Monroe, where Route 86 isn't even near there. So I think that was a completely put-up job to pump up Barron's candidacy, because that's her issue. On the other hand, what's ranked as one of the two top issues nationally, which is the war in Iraq, was not even one of the five issues they supposedly found in this district. So I thought that was quite remarkable. They found an issue being important, which I sure cannot detect anybody thinks it's important, and they found no evidence that the war in Iraq was a top issue when everybody else in the country is reporting that it is. So I thought that was as crooked a piece as you could ever see. And why they are trying to manipulate this, well, that's one of the questions. Who is trying to manipulate this and why? But I thought it was crooked journalism, and there's no real doubt about it in my mind, and there's been some of that.
Based on, other than the war in Iraq, based on your conversations with people, what would you rank as the top five issues in this district?
I would say that the number one issue is what I think is the number one issue is reflected in the people, that we are losing control of our country. People articulate this in different ways. You know, they may just say, oh, well, the politicians don't listen, and whatever they'll say to you. But we all feel it. This has now become a kind of universal feeling in America that the people in Washington don't care what the people really think, are not in office for the welfare of the people. So I have to say, I think that's number one. Certainly number two is the economic well-being. I wouldn't say that's tied with the war. I would say I can't rank them exactly. I don't have polling data either. This is subjective. The war in Iraq and the general feeling that people are going to be dying, and where does this end, and what are we getting ourselves into? That and the feeling that our prosperity is gone, and what little financial well-being most of us have is slipping away. I would say those are the other top three issues. And then I think that really places four and five are harder to put a finger on. I think that the environment is something that a lot of people really care about. So, that certainly is right up there. And there certainly are, and healthcare is certainly right up there. But people put that in different ways. People think small sometimes. They are very concerned about threats to close hospitals. They're very concerned about the loss of Medicare benefits or Medicaid benefits. And it's not that they're all clamoring for a single-payer system, but a lot of people are, and a lot of people are receptive to it. But, you can't find a conservative Republican in this country, much less a Democrat, who doesn't know that it's almost impossible and backbreaking to pay medical bills in this country. So those are big issues, but there are other things that people care about. Some people are less maybe environmentally inclined, and they care a great deal about the oil and alternative energy. And these issues are so closely linked, it's really hard to separate them.
And in the course of your travels around the 29th District, speaking to voters, how have they reacted to your campaign positions?
I think this is one reason that there's this effort to drive me out of the race, because I'm actually pretty popular wherever I speak to people. People respond. Let me read you this statement. This is the little statement we gave out when we were trying to get people to sign my petition. It says, "I stand for changing America's priorities. Money that was urgently needed here at home was squandered on a war for oil, a war based entirely on lies. We need to rebuild our country by making the minimum wage a living wage, by withdrawing from the trade agreements that are sending our jobs overseas, by providing universal health care, and by investing in schools, renewable energy, and low-income housing. If the powers that be in Washington have their way, we will become a nation of, by, and for the rich. But we are not that country. We are a free people with a sovereign right to govern ourselves. Restoring our democracy is the mission of my campaign." Well, you know, compared to what you hear in the national political scene, that sounds pretty radical. You certainly don't even hear the supposed, you know, fake leftist on these left-right debates you hear on TV. It doesn't say anything like that. But Ellen and I independently estimate that of the Democrats we give this statement to, 98 to 99% signed the petition, and a significant percentage, maybe half, were grabbing the clipboard before they'd gotten halfway through. Even more telling, you know, a significant percentage of the Republicans we showed this to said they agreed with it. So I think, you know, we're in a situation where the sentiment on the streets is not reflected in the suites. These are the things you're not supposed to say in America, but people really respond to it when you do say them. So I think I'm being very well received, and I think I have a real chance to win, because if I can get my message out there, people agree with it.
What about your opponent?
Well, let me read you what she says about Iraq. This is just one of the many issues she covers. When she finally started taking positions, because I've kind of pushed her into it, saying what an insult it was that she didn't have any. And this is what she says on the Iraq War. "Sam," that's short for Samra, "Sam cares deeply about the well-being of our troops. She believes that their bravery calls for our highest praise and deepest appreciation. Wherever they are serving, Sam thanks our troops on behalf of a grateful nation. She believes that if the federal government decides to take military action and sends our troops into harm's way, we must be prepared to arm them with the resources necessary to do their job." Well, you know, I could go on taking this apart for a long time. In the first place, she's not taken any kind of stand. There's nothing in there. Is this a just war or not? Well, isn't that a little question people might want to know if they're being asked to go maybe and fight and die over there? Shouldn't their political representatives have an opinion about that? She cares about the well-being. Well, who doesn't care? It's insulting. Is she running against someone who doesn't care about the well-being of our troops? It's grandiose. "Sam thanks our troops on behalf of a grateful nation." And then she believes that if the federal government decides to take military action, remember, she's running for Congress. She's not some spectator on the sidelines. If the government does, she's going to have a say in whether the government does this. And people have a right to know, is she going to fight against these kinds of wars, or is she just going to go for it? She says, if we send them, we must be prepared to arm them with the resources necessary. Well, she acts as if she's running against people who are ungrateful to the troops and don't want to arm them properly, send them into combat naked. That is just one cut away from the Republican right-wing position that you're not a patriot if you don't back the war, and you're soft on defense if you question this policy. So her positions, as far as I'm concerned, are best when they're meaningless, phony, silly drivel. But as soon as she actually does start to say anything, it gets worse. So, you know, she's not somebody I could have ever left this race to and said, oh, the Democrats have got a candidate, why am I going to come into this race? She is, as far as I'm concerned, an absolutely awful candidate.
And what do you think explains the strong support she has from these Democratic committees? The 29th is an overwhelmingly Republican district. I believe you told me at another time that the Republican versus Democratic registered voters are 3-1. It's basically been gerrymandered so that it's expected to be a shoe-in for Republicans. Why would you expect the Democrats to field such a weak and inexperienced candidate?